Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 89, section 9, which is old single column, page 983. Okay, we just have the finishing touches of this paper. Remember, we've been building up through the whole long, often brutal and complicated sequence of events and concepts that culminate in the current concept of the atonement. And, you know, it's in this next to the last section that they put the finishing touches on that sequence. And then we have a final section where we're going to deal with that loose end of redefining the word sin so that we can begin to liberate it from this long, complicated saga. And you'll see that I'll bring in some comments about atonement itself as a little aside, so that we can better appreciate exactly what kind of a transition we're talking about. You'll see that they made a comment way back many papers from where we are now to that very point. So we'll go back and remind ourselves of that. Let's see. I guess maybe just the one other little comment is, remember the key concept that has finally come fully into play is redemption. And remember how we've been seeing all of these words that became theological technical terms, at least amongst the significant religions of the mind. Now there's all of these technical terms like covenant and redemption and ransom and atonement and et cetera. That was the basic key ingredient that we needed to have in place before you can just sort of say, okay, and now we've got atonement. All right, so let's take a look at what they give us here.
Section 9, Sacrifices and Sacraments. The human sacrifice throughout the course of the evolution of your ancient rituals has advanced from the bloody business of man-eating to higher and more symbolic levels. The early rituals of sacrifice bred the later ceremonies of sacrament. In more recent times, the priest alone would partake of a bit of the cannibalistic sacrifice, or a drop of human blood, and then all would partake of the animal substitute. These early ideas of ransom, redemption, and covenants have evolved into the later day sacramental services, and all this ceremonial evolution has exerted a mighty, mighty socializing influence.
Why don't we just touch upon that last little comment first, because I've made a point of bringing that out. Even in its very crude beginnings, there was always this tendency to be pushing things, towards abstracting from the literal, and having that being a next step, and then abstracting further from the literalness of that for the next step, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a process of greater and greater abstraction so that you can leave behind the literalness of material things in front of you and begin to get it up into the mind. And having gotten it to the mind, now the revelators are encouraging us to take the next steps of abstraction, to abstract the fact of literal spirit from its shadow in mind. Right, to take that next step and get to a religion of spirit, and complete this long journey that started as a religion of matter. And hence, it's not technically a religion at all. Right? It's only called a religion of matter or a religion of mind because superconsciously, right, there's a relationship to spirit by grace. But the phrase itself, matter or mind, is speaking to the consciousness of the individuals. You want to get your consciousness actually up to spirit. Okay? Instead of it, and so you don't have to technically put quotes around the word religion when you use it, right? To indicate that you're just playing with the shadow and not the substance. But that whole abstraction process, like I was saying, is when they say, and all this ceremonial evolution, that the evolution has exerted a mighty socializing influence. As you push it away from these very primitive, immediate, literal issues, you're going to naturally have humans that in other areas are more sophisticated as well. And so the civilization in general will advance as what you can think of as the nucleus of civilization is advanced. And so that's what they're indicating by that mighty socializing influence. And then to look at the rest of that paragraph, as I said up front, notice they're just reminding you of the exact same thing, right? There's this whole long convoluted process that started with quote unquote the bloody business of man eating, right, and such things, and has gone all the way through, and then you see like they're saying throwing out some of those technical terms, ransom, redemption, covenants, and maybe just another thing, note this, the title. Right? We've touched on this a little bit. We have these two words with the word sacred as a root, sacrifice and sacrament. And it again is indicates this abstraction. I mean, the literalness of sacrifice is sacred doing. Okay, you're literally thinking about the doing, whatever it is, the ritual literally. But even if there's still a ritual with a sacrament, the word you're using is a more abstract word. It's, it's the sacred element, basically, if you will. And that element might be, something literal like, a wafer of, unleavened bread or something, but just conceptually an element. You have these fundamental element, conceptual elements in your theology that you've boiled things down to, the sacraments, and then your whole scheme is built upon those fundamental sacred elements. Okay, notice that they put it in the order, sacrifices and sacraments, because they want to just remind you that you now have the point where the foundational fact is this abstract concept. It evolved sacraments and sacrifices. It started with sacrifices and eventually added the concept of sacrament on top of that. But they flipped that around to indicate, we've come all the way around and you may not bring in any sort of literal concept of sacrifice at all in some religious modes, or you've tried to just put it all in an event 2,000 years ago, Jesus' sacrifice, but it's, you know, it's not the foundational element anymore. This more abstract concept is. And again, that just is kind of, the word sacrifice can immediately think of material issues, but sacrament is some intellectual issue, more fundamentally. So again, it's that religion, from the religion of matter to religion of mind. Okay, let's see. I guess that's, let's keep going here.
In connection with the Mother of God cult in Mexico and elsewhere, a sacrament of cakes and wine was eventually utilized in lieu of the flesh and blood of the older human sacrifices. The Hebrews long practiced this ritual as a part of their Passover ceremonies, and it was from this ceremonial that the later Christian version of the sacrament took its origin.
See how they're kind of, really giving you the spectrum and culminating it with the Christian concept. Like I said, we're sort of building up to the atonement doctrine, of Christianity. And when they, remind you of that whole mother cult, or here is a kind of, say it out in longer form, Mother of God cult that stemmed from Eve, specifically related to Cain. When they say the Mother of God cult and they say Mexico, you probably are immediately thinking of Our Lady of Guadalupe, right? But, go before that. Go to the more ancient, immediately Aztec concept of a mother goddess that was absorbed and reworked, into the Virgin Mary, and gave rise to the whole events that gave us. Our Lady of Guadalupe, as a version of the Virgin, but they're reminding you that that Mother of God cult was very compelling to many peoples and spread far and wide from its source there, to the east of Mesopotamia, where Cain went. Including getting all the way over to the Americas, at least Central and South America. You go, well, wait a minute, how has that happened? I mean, talking about stemming from Eve, they were there long before Eve. How did they get it? Remember? Who came across the Pacific? I had a handful of Andites. And sure enough, right, it feeds the Mother of God cult into Central and South America. It was, not only do you have the immediate kind of linear lineage to get to the bread and wine concept in Christianity, obviously reinforced in his, as an evolutional effort on Jesus' part by what Jesus did with the Remembrance Supper, but nonetheless, it's there and it's you. One way or another, Jesus knew it would get into the religion that, would be spawned in the wake of him. So he tried to make a point of clarifying it overtly, right, rather than just letting the vicissitudes of evolution feed in something or other. He tried to get it a little bit more focused and definitive by formalizing, directly formalizing it for them. They still reworked it, into the evolutionary stream. But nonetheless, besides that very kind of linear antecedent to what's in Christianity, they're reminding you that it's all over the place. So it gives an inroad for Christianity to grab a hold of where people are in other places in the world evolutionarily and say, well, you don't have to really give up anything that you have. We're just going to clarify for you more precisely what that's about. You kind of had the basic notion, and now we'll just add a little bit of specificity, right? What that mother goddess there of you Aztecs is all about, that's about the Virgin Mary, right? And they can just move right, they don't really have to have any sort of a stark discontinuity, in their evolution of religion. So that's what they're just reminding you of. It was all over, and it was a means of Christianity spreading without a lot of intense resistance. So that's like I said, they're just going to give you again another thread of how we build up to Christianity.
The ancient social brotherhoods were based on the rite of blood drinking. The early Jewish fraternity was a sacrificial blood affair. Paul started out to build a new Christian cult on, quote, the blood of the everlasting covenant, unquote. And while he may have unnecessarily encumbered Christianity with teachings about blood and sacrifice, he did once and for all make an end of the doctrines of redemption through human or animal sacrifices. His theologic compromises indicate that even revelation must submit to the graduated control of evolution. According to Paul, Christ became the last and all-sufficient human sacrifice. The divine judge is now fully and forever satisfied.
Okay, see, they wanted to bring in a little bit more specificity the flesh and blood pairing that they were mentioning in the preceding paragraph is not sort of there's not equal weight on the two elements there. As we've saw going way back, blood is a very, very key element in all of evolutionary religion. It gets an additional emphasis in the way Paul presents things and how he gets them to take what they have and morph it into what he'd like them to have. So things like the blood of the everlasting covenant, expressions like that. But, notice they're reminding you of how these concepts of covenant and you see redemption there also, those are getting their, their final in Christianity anyway, tweak of definition. And then the final statement there, when all is said and done, with so many things, we have to let the evolution of the mainstream be what it is, take its glacial pace. Ultimately, if you try to do something fundamentally other than let it take its evolutionary pace, that's the rebellion. Right, there's ultimate respect for the evolutionary process amongst the entire hierarchy of celestial beings.
Unless it's revelation.
Yeah, but even revelation.
You're not saying revelation's rebellion, right?
No. Yeah, so let me clarify that. Right, revelation is definitely not rebellion, but it has to be very carefully crafted so that it isn't. It could easily be a rebellion if you weren't very focused on making that revelation evolutional and not revolutional. Right,
the moment. We've seen that.
Right, right. It's actually a kind of a shadow of a hair's turning in some areas. It's a very precise art for the descending sons to engage a world and not cross that line, where they're sort of, you know, which is fundamentally the line that they're crossing if you take it to its endpoints. The one endpoint is righteousness and the other endpoint is self-righteousness, right? When you cross that line. So, you know, they can't put themselves first. They've got to put the big picture first. They've got to put the supreme first.
And they're taught that ahead of time.
And they're taught that very precisely. And you know, but we've seen that they know this is complicated, and so the Most Highs make sure that there's a group of the prince's staff that can be taught better than the rest, and hence will not be deceived across that line. And of course, in general, the planetary prince or the system sovereign is, you know, is supposed to be an overseer of this, so that the underlings, you know, if they have a blind spot, he shouldn't have that blind spot, and they shouldn't, you know, no one should cross the line. But, you know, it can break down like it did in our local system. But, you know, that, you know, you've got to basically respect. So if you feel, you know, take it to yourself. If you just feel an unresolvable tension between the glacial pace or the primitive state of the main evolutionary stream, there's good news. You can step out into the parallel stream. You don't have to, you know, unnecessarily burden yourself by staying in the mainstream. Just step out. I mean, the fifth epical revelation, more than any revelation ever, you know, of the previous four, you know, compared to the previous four, the fifth is telling you, do it, right? If you know, assess the situation. If you feel, I just can't abide there, it's just too small a space, you shall know the truth and the truth shall set you free. You can step out and liberate your mind. It's okay. God is not going to look askance at you because you're not staying with the pack. Okay? He doesn't demand that we all stay with the pack. But the fact that there is a pack, you know, is inescapable. All right, and we have to be tolerant of that. If you're going to step out, then don't turn around and be intolerant. Right? You need to be tolerant of where they are. You need to respect where they are. God loves them exactly the same as you. And let them take the pace that they need to take. Let's see here. Anything else there? You know, notice the one little element that they're bringing in that you might not have thought of, you know, that it's, there's not just the religious concepts of blood, but just the social concepts of blood. You know, that's what binds you together as a society, you know, is, you know, you, various blood oaths or pacts or whatever, you know, I mean, so Paul knew all that. He knew that, you know, if you focused on that, people could really resonate with that concept. You could hold everyone together in the blood of Christ. All right, just that, using those words would have a deep resonance in the natural mind of man. You know, including all those that don't think it through in any theological way at all. Okay, so, you know, and he certainly was thinking in an evolutionary sense of, you know, let's just make there's, you know, this final satisfaction of Jesus' death. However, you know, notice, you know, we talked about that satisfaction word, you know, it's one of these technical terms. You know, the evolutionary religious stream couldn't totally let go of satisfaction. You still, you know, you go to confession, right? You got to figure out what you need to do so that God is satisfied. Right, you're still thinking that, at least in a minor degree, he's not satisfied yet, and you've got to dot some I's and cross some T's. Yeah. So Paul was only marginally successful, you know, in just putting an end to that debt concept. Yeah. All right, let's see, what's the final little element here?
And so, after long ages, the cult of the sacrifice has evolved into the cult of the sacrament. Thus are the sacraments of modern religion the legitimate successors of those shocking early ceremonies of human sacrifice and the still earlier cannibalistic rituals. Many still depend upon blood for salvation, but it has at least become figurative, symbolic, and mystic.
Yeah, so we've made it more abstract. Like I was saying, it's so natural to think of blood as indispensable to salvation. That's why Paul went that way. That's why it works as well as it does still today, despite all of the tensions that have developed because of the Enlightenment and whatnot. You know, in terms of the superstitions, you know, in Christianity.
It's now
a
wine.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, but, you know, it's, some Christians go more with the symbolic, some go more with the mystic, right? You know, it varies from Christian sect to Christian sect. But, you know, still, it's just, it's a very powerful concept.
Okay? To me, it was always the way to get Jesus inside you, ate him.
Right.
You know, you ate his body,
you
drank his blood.
Now, right, feeds into the feeds into the fetish concept. You know, you're now inspirited, in Jesus'd. You know, all that stuff that just feels so fulfilling. And you know, again, just, you know, be honest with yourself. If all that is adequately fulfilling to you, don't concern yourself with all of these very challenging, rugged things that the fifth epical revelation is telling you about prayer or whatnot. You know, just forget about it. It's fine. Right? There's nothing in the book that's necessary for salvation. You know, if you can't fully embrace salvation by grace and take your salvation for granted, find the current symbolic debt sacrifice concept, you know, that works for you, and be fine with it.
Your book, if you were Christian, you did take communion, you definitely got some sort of a feeling out of it. It definitely was a spiritual.
Of course.
It doesn't mean as much today, but it sure did mean something when you knew anything different.
Of course. So say, I mean, I was raised in the Christian church, I mean, and all that was very, very significant for me growing up. Right? It's I walked through that whole developmental process. It's just like, unlike many, I kept on walking until I stepped out of it. And fortunately, the moment I started to step out of it, this book landed in my lap. Right? And I had something to keep walking on. Now, like I said, let's just take one little aside. You notice that they were hinting all over between the lines about the atonement doctrine there, talking about Paul and whatnot. But, you know, they didn't literally mention it. Let's sum it up. So you've got, you know, because after all, it's sin, sacrifice, and atonement is the title of this paper. So that culminating word, atonement. Now, obviously, as they're saying at the end there, figurative, symbolic, mystic, you know, you can separate the concept of atonement you know, basically completely from all of the literal primitive notions from which it evolved. Okay, you don't have to have any literalness to body and blood, you know, or anything or whatnot. Okay, but even if you do all that, and even if you remind yourself of what the word means literally, so that you aren't just thinking of it as a sequence of letters that indicates a particular technical term in a theology, right? If you remind yourself of the literalness of at-one-ment, right? I mean, that's not a play on words. That's the word literally. That's what the word literally is mean. They're just gluing the at and the one together to get a tone. Okay. Even if you do that, right, so that you've tried to bound yourself away from primitive theology, superstitious theology, and whatnot as much as you can, you still only have the concept of at-one-ment that you believe you need to seek. See, and it's time for those who are ready to take the next step and recognize that you don't have anything to seek there anymore. You have at-one-ment by grace now. Right? That's over with. It's like, well, if I totally let go of it, even as at-one-ment, let alone atonement, what do I pick up? What concept do I focus on instead of that? Okay, and that's why I said you don't have to go back, because it's just a tiny little single sentence paragraph that I wanted to read. But it's way back, I think that's paper 39, isn't it? It's way back in paper 39 on it's entitled The Seraphic Hosts. It's like the last place you'd think of looking for kind of a really significant sentence about atonement and how to evolve it forward, but that's where the sentence is. And as a little aside, as they're talking about the planetary helpers, remember you have that flavor of angels called the planetary helpers, like the voices in the garden, right? It's the first group of those planetary helpers, like Salonia. One of those groups of planetary helper angels are called the souls of peace. You know, and you know by the name you can tell they're going to have to do with the whole peace on earth. Fostering, you know, towards peace on earth and brotherhood among men, or goodwill among men. But they have a little aside, and they say, in the more advanced epochs of planetary evolution, these seraphim are instrumental in supplanting the atonement idea by the concept of divine attunement as a philosophy of mortal survival. So don't just turn atonement into at-one-ment and think you've done what the fifth epical revelation is asking you to do. No, you haven't really done anything there except play a game with yourself. At-one-ment is atonement, literally. Okay? You want to go from at-one-ment, atonement, to attunement. And you hear me speak about various issues this way all the time. Synchronizing with deity, right? That's that attunement, right? That's what you aren't in some separated state. So that you need to get things together again. You know, remember, let's kind of flesh out the atonement concept. Atonement basically consists of, first you have the concept of redemption, like we built up, right? So that you fill in the debt hole, okay? And then reconciliation. Redemption and reconciliation, that's atonement. And it's, you know, it has its own kind of logic to it. It's like, well, I would like to get together again with God. Well, God is a something. If I'm going to get together with him, I have to be a something too. I can't be a nothing, a whole. I've got to fill up the holes. Okay, so there's redemption, Okay, now there's two somethings, and now let's bring the two somethings back together again. That's reconcile them, right? Bring them back together again. And so now we're all at one again. Okay. But see, that you don't need to do any of that. I mean, fully, now factually, right, everyone has a thought adjuster even. Right, so it's, you know, you don't even have to say in truth there's at one moment. No, in fact, there's at one moment by grace. Nothing needs to be done there. Right, it's like, well, why do I still feel apart from God? See, remember this all is, you know, humans have this feeling of divorcement or separation from. A spiritual influence. You know, and they've always rationalized that the reason they feel that way is because they bring in their guilt. It's like, well, it's probably because that thing I feel guilty about is God, you know, has separated himself from me because I did that, and that's why I feel guilty about it. But that isn't the deal, right? He loves you absolutely. As long as you exist, there's zero distance between you and God. Right? He's never separated himself, and he won't, unless you cease to exist. Okay? So, and now that's, like I said, for everyone, it's factualized. Everyone literally has a fragment of God himself within them, a fragment of his deity. So that's not the answer. There, you know, when you feel that lack of closeness to a revivifying spiritual influence in your mind, the reason for that is not that separation. You just have to take the effort to attune to it. It's right there. You don't have to go searching for it or do something to get it to come back to you. It's right in front of your eyes. All you have to do is just, the mind needs to be reformed so it attunes to that fact. It's attunement. It's that synchronization with that deity engagement or that spiritual ministry that you want to think of it that way. And know that superconsciously, it's already there. That attunement's already there. Not only is the at-one-ment there by grace, but superconsciously attunement is there by grace. But you know, you're feeling a lack of it consciously. See, so that's all you need. You just need to get to the point where you bring that attunement, that sort of modeling of attunement, down into a conscious experience. Okay. There's no debt. Right, that needs to be made up, that needs to be redeemed. Just take delight in cultivating. Supply the favorable conditions for attunement.
Yeah. I like to use the term striking step.
Striking step.
Because it's more practical and holistic.
Right.
So it brings it down to earth, and it's just a matter of, I mean, synchronizing with deity is abstract.
Yes, it is.
But if you bring it down to earth, striking step, you can relate to that.
Yeah, I was actually going to use that term and just, you know, I was just going to bring that up. I hesitated saying it up front because I wanted to hold it off, but you just, you know, brought it in. Right, because that's another more way to visualize what you mean by that kind of technical, kind of scientific-like term of synchronizing. Right, striking step. Right, righteousness is conformity with the cosmos. Attunement. Okay? Striking step with the cosmos. Synchronizing with the cosmos. And notice that in order to really focus precisely on this transition from atonement to attunement, You have to take an additional step of abstraction. I've said it several times. I'm going to synchronize with deity. Right? In contrast to atoning to God. Okay, you're taking it from that that line of individuality relationship, you know, that is inherent in the atonement concept, right, to deity. You have to actually transcend God to a deity concept. Don't try to attune to God, attune to his deity, right? Because after all, it's even, you know, the will of the Father, not the will of the universal Father, right? Not the individual designation, the universal Father, but the deity designation, the Father, synchronizing, attuning to that deity, synchronizing with that deity. Attunement. Okay, that's in the same way that when the adjutants reached down and engaged you, each adjutant attuned to your genetics. So there was all of this attunement top down. You're going to reciprocate that and start to attune, right? You were given the initial bit of upward attunement when you were encircled in the Holy Spirit, right? See, that was a synchronization up. You're gonna follow suit with that and attune more with the cosmos in following suit with that initial attunement of your encirclement in the Holy Spirit that was there by grace, put there by grace. That's what you're gonna do. Okay, so you have to really make this big step. Where kind of completing that journey of abstraction that they were talking about, where you can finally abstract the deity from the individual and see it as the ultimate goal. Because if you want to really be close to God, you need to do what he did, attuned to the deity above him. If you attune to the deity above, likewise, then those two individuals inescapably are connected together in the cosmic system. But until each is attuned to the whole above first, right, no two individuals really have a living relationship.
Two things connected to the same thing, connected to each other.
Okay, that's the thing, and you'll see that immediately as we redefine the word sin. All right? See, if we're going to redefine the word sin, it's going to be in parallel to going from atonement to attunement. So don't be surprised if it goes from God to deity. Okay.
Is that the same as from get in touch with your thought adjuster in a way?
I mean, yeah, and see, that's the other thing. Stop thinking of the adjuster in such individuality terms, like you're trying to reach and grab a point. If you want to move closer to your adjuster, right? Try to attune to the functioning of that deity fragment. Fundamentally, what he is a fragment of deity, right? And a deity has a functioning. And you're going to synchronize with that functioning. You're going to tune to that. You're going to strike step with that functioning. That's what you're gonna, what you're technically trying to do, not just, you know, get close and rub noses. Okay, individual to individual. Right, that's not the way to think about what you're doing. Right, don't think of it so statically. Think of it dynamically. Right, deity is a functioning fact. You're gonna strike step with that functioning.
Be perfect, is that a function?
Right, this whole, you know, the whole be you perfect, right? I mean, you know, it's a dynamic thing. It's spread out. You're more and more synchronized. You're following the line of perfectingness, you know, till you're perfect finitely, etc. Right? All these things can be advanced by just thinking of them in more dynamic terms. All right, so isn't that amazing when you know, that really a kind of a key thing that you need? You know, why isn't that little sentence, you know, something like that little sentence we had to go back to paper 39 for, why isn't it right here, right? As a final little paragraph in this section 9. Again, it's the book is written in this very holistic way. You have to be able to, you know, wrap your mind around the whole thing, you know, and if you can't do that, that's what a search engine's for, right? Search for the word atonement and see how many places it occurs and look at them all. And you go, oh, that's an important little element. That's sort of the bottom line statement in the whole book about atonement. You know, the positive bottom line statement, you know, you can focus on the kind of the negative bottom line statements up there in the God the Father papers, right, in the first 5 papers, you know, where they read you the riot act about, you know, being so primitive that you think of God in terms of atonement. But, you know, I don't need to be beat up anymore about how primitive I think about things. Give me something positive to strive for. Yeah, go from atonement to attunement. Okay, let's take a look at what they say about sin here.
Section 10, forgiveness of sin. Ancient man only attained consciousness of favor with God through sacrifice. Modern man must develop new techniques of achieving the self-consciousness of salvation. The consciousness of sin persists in the mortal mind, but the thought patterns of salvation therefrom have become outworn and antiquated. The reality of the spiritual need persists, but intellectual progress has destroyed the olden ways of securing peace and consolation for mind and soul.
Okay, so that's an interesting way to start. You know, they're telling you what I was saying a little bit ago. I mean, you're going to have, an essence of a mori system that you've lifted up into the upper domain that speaks to your lower domain as your voice of conscience. You're going to notice when you aren't synchronized with that voice of conscience. You're going to feel guilty, right? You know that that's what we've always called a consciousness of sin, right? As they're saying there, the consciousness of sin persists in the mortal mind, they said, right? I mean, that's what they're talking about. Right? That's not going to go away. You're not going to get rid of that conscience that's going to nag at you. It's like, you know, John, you've fallen short there, right, or whatever. Could have done a little better there, John. It haunts our minds, and that's not going to go away.
But that's how you grow.
And they're going to point out. But notice what they're saying. It's like, okay, that was put there for a reason. That's an initial kind of priming of the pump. Now, just kind of take the essence of that and uplift all of the concepts that you have about that, and you'll have something that's genuine. That's the actual substance of such issues as sin. Or you might discover that you can't seem to find any of that substance. Yeah, really, you haven't sinned at all. Right? And that's a great relief when you discover that you've exalted trivialities into that mountain of sin. And you don't have to labor under that burden, that guilt burden. Okay, but see what they're saying, modern man must develop. Okay, not it would help to develop, no, must develop, right? New techniques of achieving self-consciousness of salvation. And we were just talking about that, right? You will know definitively that you're saved when you attune. It's just there. It's self-evident that you're fine.
Well, I thought you were going to say when you resurrect.
Okay.
Yes. That too.
Right. Sure. But of course, then they'll remind you, yeah, but you haven't fused yet, you know. Okay, and you can still go astray, right? Right. See, so don't look for the sort of the fact of your literal salvation, you know, fusion with your thought adjuster. I mean, when we're talking about this attunement and beyond certainty, that certitude that you can have, right? It's there. The truth of your salvation is there to be just as definitively held onto, right? In the essence of that attunement, right? You know, the consciousness that's only there, you know, as part of your reflective mind, your self-conscious mind, as they're pointing out there, right? Achieving the self-consciousness of salvation. It'll be there, right? You will know God literally, no longer the God notion. You'll know you're a son of that God, and that God has engaged you. That's why you can know him, and what God has joined together, no one can put asunder, right? Your salvation is a given, right? You know, the only way that can change is if you absolutely reject God as a finite being, a tall order indeed, okay? Trivialities are irrelevant, okay? Finite rejection doesn't do it. Absentite rejection doesn't do it. You have to absolutely reject him. Okay? So it's like,
go and tell us, everybody.
Right, of course. You know, we all know. See, this is we're talking to those who have stepped out into the parallel stream. A lot of these things, if you say it to the main evolutionary stream, that kind of stuff is what Lucifer was saying, and it blew up everything. I mean, right, because they need fear, you know, or there's going to be anarchy. But for those who are ready to step out, okay, and take on the internal integrity, don't need to be constrained externally to the nth degree.
So back to what you're saying.
This is good news.
So that's kind of what Christians tell you that Jesus did for you. In this whole thing. So,
right.
You know, but in a different way. In other words, you are saved because Jesus died for your sins, so you really don't have to worry about it.
Yeah.
And that's a little bit different than what you're saying in terms of how it sinks inside. In other words, it seems that the world has been able to soak that one up, and they haven't gone wacko about it. Or in other words, my thinking is that if everybody knew that they were totally saved, you know, it would be easy for them to become bad people just as well as good people, so to speak, because it really wouldn't matter to to them as much. You mentioned the fear aspect, but the Christian religion has basically told them the same thing in a different way, because Jesus, you know, perpetuated, or you know what I'm saying, mediated between that and died for your sins. So back to what you were saying a second ago, at what point do you think civilization evolves enough to where they can handle this concept?
Okay, well, it's, most of, you know, a major portion of civilization can't evolve to it right now because the genetics won't allow it. Right, a lot of this is, you know, the lack of the biologic uplift. I mean, because it's, you know, you have to have the ability to really engage the upper domain consciously more than most people can genetically achieve right now. Right? So,
and yet they can get part of it in the religions of the world.
I mean, see, you know, one of the reasons why Michael did what he did, way out of order, is he gave people superconsciously what they really can't achieve themselves consciously because of genetic limitation. You know, the spirit of truth, as the spirit of unification, bridges the gap, right, and allows you to get a thought adjuster even as a seventh circler. You don't have to get up consciously to the level where, you know, it comes, you know, something that's effectively a third circler sort of a thing. So, you know, we have to remember, you know, there's until something significant is done, you know, like, say, by Machiavelli and Melchizedek, not only assuming planetary prince and coming here, but, you know, taking the role of material sun and helping us with genetic engineering and, right, you know, all this, all those things that Adam and Eve should have done, you know, when over their 25,000 years and would have been done at 10,000 BC, right? Until that is done, I mean, the bulk of humanity can't go very far forward. Okay.
Well, that says to me that the revelation is way ahead of its time, so to speak, unless that's going to happen without us knowing.
Again, because this is not, you know, a dispensation. If this was done as a dispensational revelation, it would be way ahead of its time. But it's not, right? Because you can't take the whole planet dispensationally forward like this. Like I'm saying, it's not possible genetically, if nothing else. Let alone all of the difficulty of overcoming the inertia, you know, of concepts, you know, that, right, whatnot. But just the genetic issue, you know, makes it universally impossible to go very far forward. But there's always those that have enough that it can step out. I mean, Gabriel saw to it that Michael was incarnated in a body with genetics so that he could, you know, fundamentally get enough out of that boat anchor and go all the way forward. Right? If you'd stuck Michael in limited genetics, he couldn't have gotten to the point of fusion. You know, no matter how experienced his adjuster was. Just can't get there. So, you know, it's important, you know, how many times they remind you that, you know, your big problems are genetics, and okay, until that's dealt with, there's, you know, the bulk is not going to go anywhere. But for those who, you know, who can resonate with these concepts that are so much more abstract, and that's fundamentally due to genetics, they're telling you, let's go for it. Don't limit yourself to the ignorance of others. You aren't fundamentally limited genetically, so, you know, don't make yourself limited because you impose what genetics didn't impose by doing it just mindily, right? I mean, don't be your own worst enemy. Let go of the old frame. You can do it, and so do. And push forward and go beyond. You know, you could say, why didn't the idea of Jesus put an end to this whole thing once and for all, like they're pointing out that Paul tried to set up? You know, you were bringing that up. But notice that it didn't really work, because they don't take their salvation, Christians in general do not take their salvation for granted. They spend every moment of every day worrying about their salvation. And worrying that, you know, if I read that non-sanctioned book, I probably won't be saved anymore or something, and they don't even dare open the cover of it, or, you know, I mean, they're just filled with the fear of falling out of God's favor and not being saved anymore.
And many of them even, fairly advanced genetics.
Even though theologically they're supposed to, you know, have this concept that they're saved, period, end of story. See, what's the difference? The problem is, all they're told is to believe that Jesus' death saved them. Jesus' sacrifice saved them. When we're talking about this certitude I was talking about with attunement, it has nothing to do with belief, mere belief. I don't believe that I'm saved through attunement. I know that I am saved through this attunement process. There's a self-evident recognition that comes with it. It's a knowing. It's not merely believing. It's an upper domain knowing, not a lower domain believing. That's the issue. That Christians, they don't really know that they're saved. They just try to believe and remind themselves, I gotta believe I'm saved. I mean, why do they have to keep coming back to church every Sunday and be reminded that they're saved? Because they have to try to reinforce that belief, which is fleeting. Okay? You know, if you once know you're saved, no one will ever have to give you a booster shot again. It's done.
Yeah.
right now there's there's kind of two flavors. It does say the olden ways did secure peace and consolation mm-hmm. for mind and soul.
Yeah.
So the evangelicals, to a degree, are trying to go back to the olden ways.
Mm-hmm.
And they do, sort of.
Yeah.
But they do it at the expense of their intellectual progress.
Mm-hmm.
The mainline churches that persist in moving forward with intellectual progress it's destroying their peace.
Mm-hmm.
So they try to achieve peace through good works.
Right, or they try to find it through a political means, or something, we need to change the political system and then I'll feel at peace, or...
But it's all external.
Yeah, it's all external, And hence it can't be enduring peace. It can't be peace that passes all understanding, right? It's all just a game you try to play with yourself that, if this person is elected, okay, then I can feel at peace. I mean, you're just fooling yourself. It's irrelevant who's elected, right? I mean, the world could still blow up tomorrow.
So that's why they talk in the fourth part about, now the time is ripe for Jesus thing, because of the fact that his main teaching, that you're all men are the sons of God, that's basically saying the same thing you're saying,
mm-hmm.
but it's a different approach to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's more, and they say, that if you thoroughly believe that, that's really what... That will get you everywhere.
To fairly know that. So you just add that one step, right?
I think they say,
The God knowing this on the sixth level of meaning, there's a son knowing this that comes with that.
That's true.
See?
It starts out...
You no longer just believe you're a son of God because someone told you that, that you were. You know it of your own conscious recognition. Right?
For me, I started out believing it, and then I began to know it.
Right.
And just know it without believing it.
I mean, that's how you get a child of God up to an adult of God. A child of God has to just be told to believe it because they can't know it. And eventually, right, if you just stick with that and supply some favorable conditions like loyal, humble, sincere, right, you'll be grown up to an adult of God and then you'll know it. Right? Yeah.
What does not help is that in the Catholic Church they say, well, Jesus was the only begotten Son of God.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no recognition of any other sons at all.
Yeah, sure. I mean, all the parochial nature of so much theology, right? I mean, we're starting to feel those tensions. The more we just develop science fiction, the more it feeds back an attention on those very circumscribed theological notions that this is the only inhabited planet, and Jesus is the only begotten Son, literally, etc. Sure, there's as they're pointing out, how did they say that? But the thought patterns of salvation therefrom have become outworn and antiquated. Right? There's just so many different ways that the theological notions are outworn and antiquated. They just, they're being nibbled at from every direction. Okay, and so like they're saying, you at some point you got to recognize that I must not have a hold of something indelible if anything can eat at it. Maybe I should seek something that's more solid. Right? So that's what they're saying, right? I mean, and eventually all mankind must do that, but that'll come in, through the long process that the planetary administrators and whatnot decide for how we're going to move this planet forward genetically and all that sort of stuff. That's a huge, complicated problem. By and large, the relators are all, I have no idea how that's going to work. I mean, they don't know how it's going to play out either. Right, it's just all very complicated. But anyway, back to the specifics here. This next paragraph gives us that new definition of sin, and and it's you know, we've recognized in our discussion here that it's this is not directed at the general populace. It's directed at that parallel stream, but it's still the case that in that parallel stream, the operative word is must. Right? You must redefine. Okay? If you're going to have, if you're going to find a synchronization within that parallel stream, many things must be redefined. Right? Or they're just non sequiturs. They will shatter your relationship to that parallel stream, and you'll fall back into the main evolutionary stream. So you, in order to stay synchronized with that, all these things, these key elements have to be redefined.
Sin must be redefined as deliberate disloyalty to deity. There are degrees of disloyalty. The partial disloyalty of indecision, the divided loyalty of confliction, the dying loyalty of indifference, and the death of loyalty exhibited in devotion to godless ideals.
Okay, so before we expand completely on that, an italicized sentence that redefines sin, let's just think for a second about what else they've decided to put into that paragraph with it. A whole sequence keyed on one word, loyal. Oh, that's the first word in our handful of favorable condition words, loyal, humble, sincere, just, patient. Right? Loyal, the tadpole thing. Right? And they define this new definition for sin uses the word loyal. Okay, so that's a very key element they're trying to tell you, to reflect on that. To get very focused on it, or get focused on it well, you know, you have to bring in things like I talk about, you know, remember the words legal and loyal are actually the same word. Okay? They evolved separate, even though that they're etymologically the same word. And they evolved into an interesting parallel. One of them is the individuality word and the other is the unity word. It's the two sides of one coin. It's the unity side and the individuality side. Legal is the individuality word, and loyal is the unity word. Okay. So, as they're giving this sequence relative to loyalty, they're obviously, see, then talking about a diminishing synchronization with unity. That there's less unity, and less and less, and we don't need to unpack all the elements of that sequence. You can spend some time reflecting on those, but just giving you a sense of how you can have a more and more tenuous relationship with unity, in other words, with value, can't help but be a thing. But if there's less and less value juxtaposed to the thing, then obviously there's less and less meaning to you as an individual. So that diminishing value, that diminishing meaning, all in the sense of diminishing loyalty, diminishing synchronization with unity. Okay, and then the definition itself. So, until this sentence was put down on a piece of paper and italicized, the only concept humans had of sin is the one that we've just gone through the whole evolution of how it developed. Right? It's transgression of taboo. Right? That whole conscience thing we were talking about, that consciousness of sin, consciousness of the transgression of taboo. Right? The key thou shalt not elements of the Mori system that you've lifted up into the upper domain and speak to the lower domain where your ears are, right? Right? You should feel guilty. You've just transgressed a taboo. Okay, it's not that. And even when you bring it all the way up like they did, where the taboo is divorced from nature spirits and lowercase g gods and, you know, what have you, and is just down to a monotheistic rationalization, you know, that you have transgressed a fundamental element that puts you in relationship to capital G God. Okay? It's not that, right? And to understand fundamentally what genuine sin is about, you have to let go, like we were saying a while ago, of this individual to God relationship, individual to individual relationship, and whether or not that the two are together, working together, you know, whether or not they're at one, quote unquote, you know, whether or not they're reconciled. You know, it's not that. It's this attunement to deity issue. Deliberate disloyalty to deity. Fundamental quality of deity is unity. See, we see our loyal word, our unity word. You're apart from that unity, disloyal. And, you know, once they give you that proper definition like that, it's very easy to establish the parallel definition of what's the difference between evil and sin. Well, evil is disloyalty to deity, but not deliberate disloyalty to deity. That's sin, right? If you add the deliberate, then it goes from evil to sin. You know, evil, we talk about all the time, you know, badness. I mean, it's that unit. It's about unity. It's about your synchronization, how much you've struck step with unity, as it were, how much you're coordinated with unity.
There's a new bag of chips out called Lesser Evil.
Since there's many kinds of chips, it couldn't be the lesser of two evils. It was just the lesser. Yeah.
It's just lesser evil. I can't eat this.
It just feels like a taboo violation to me. Yes.
I got through that one.
but see, just notice that they didn't say deliberate disloyalty to God. See, because you want to move from atonement to attunement, and it's attunement to deity. It's this whether or not you've synchronized with that most transcendent, ubiquitous stuff that's a dynamic fact. You know, it functions. It's kind of, it is, it's functioning. You're synchronizing with that function. You got to strike step with it, right? You can't just walk up to it and put your finger on it. It's like, okay, now we're together, right? There's that one-ment. No, you've got to strike step with this. It's fundamentally an infinitely dynamic phenomenon that you're striking step with. Okay, and whether or not. See, so think about what that implies. You know, this deliberate disloyalty to deity. I can say, you know, my mind and the way it naturally wants to function, I'm not going to put that first. I'm going to put the functioning of transcendent deity first, and I'm going to strike step with that. See, this deliberate disloyalty to deity is deliberate desynchronization with deity, right? It's what are you then striking step with? Yourself. It's the path to self-righteousness, right, that you're taking. Because you can't help but strike step with something. Don't strike step with yourself. You have to consciously choose to not do that. In contrast to the animal origin incessant clamoring that wants to do nothing but strike step with itself, wants to define goodness relative to yourself. Things that are pleasant to myself are good. Things that are unpleasant to myself are bad. Right, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. I could be totally off, but does Moda have anything to do with, or does motion have anything to do with deity?
Obviously, once I get up to be able to have a Marantxa mind in a full holistic motion called Moda, I can synchronize all the more holistically with this functioning of deity. There's always going to be room for improvement in synchronizing with something, like I said, that's fundamentally an infinite functioning. Okay, that's infinitely dynamic. Okay, a big step towards that end will being able to kind of get your mind really in a holistic motion, which you can't do right now. And that's what motion consciousness, Moda consciousness is, right? That full three-dimensional motion, if you will, of your mind that can synchronize with the three-dimensional motion of deity. But nonetheless, right, by the grace gifts that have been engaged to you, even if you can't get it very significantly, in fact, you can get, you know, this attunement in truth. The spirit of truth will certainly help you with that, if nothing else. Okay, and the adjuster will catalyze it, etc. Okay, you can get the essence of what you need now. You don't need a lot of attunement now. You're a limited fact. You know, when you're a finaliter, right, in order to be a finaliter, it requires a vast attunement. Okay, and you can do that then. You don't need that kind of attunement now. You're just you're an unfertilized egg right now. How much does an unfertilized egg need for attunement? Just a little bit. Okay? Yeah.
Just to keep it clear always, God is personalized deity, and we're striking it
yes.
up with him also.
Yes.
To not have it be a dichotomy in some people's minds, because
yes.
he is always, it all works together.
Yes.
It's not one or the other.
Yes. So
just keep that in mind, everyone.
Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. Yeah. To bring it around, right? I mean, it's like, well, what is this deity I'm saying? Well, start with your monotheism, if that's where you are, right? And just add to it that instead of just saying God, and it's nothing but mystery beyond that word, okay? Add the little element that God is personalized deity, okay? So have two elements besides just a single thought of God. Okay, he's a person, and he's deity. Okay? And let me synchronize with his deity. Let me consecrate my will to the perfect will of God the Father. Let me synchronize with his deity. And see, instead of thinking about, okay, his will, okay, it's a sequence of words, let me write it down, okay, then I've got to follow those. Instead of thinking like that about consecrating your will to his will, think about it as you have something that can strike step with a functioning in him, okay? Synchronize with it, attune to it. Think of it like that, rather than trying to follow his orders or something like that, okay? Think about striking step with the functioning of his deity. You know, and it's like, well, can you give me some hints? It's still very abstract. Well, that's what we do all the time. Father deity, Father's the initiator and the directionizer. Strike step with that. I'm going to try to add genuine originality to the world around me, or starting with myself. I'm going to be an initiator and a directionizer. Those are a little bit abstract, but you know, again, you know, where did they throw in that whole bit about philosophy? Can't remember where they said that here just a second ago. But you know, you inescapably have a philosophy. Oh, I know where it was. It was back here. About the attunement, divine attunement as a philosophy of mortal survival. I mean, you can't just think in simple, primitive religious terms, okay? I mean, to get anywhere, you have to bring in a philosophic context. Okay, so you have to be able to be comfortable and wrap your mind around these more abstract notions in order to really do this. Yep.
And bringing it down to our level, which is very simply, maybe like getting along with each other is kind of striking step with each other and the functioning of another human being.
Yeah, I mean, all this can you know, when you, you know, this attunement to deity, okay, is going to be your morality. You know, in the genuine sense of the word morality, instead of all these external notions that people have about the word morality. I mean, morality exists only in the upper domain. It's a pure inner life fact. If you achieve this attunement, this synchronization, this striking step inside, that will immediately cast a shadow down and out to an improved ethics with others, right? You'll strike step with them, right? If you first strike step with the cosmos, and imagine how much better the two of you will strike step with each other if they also strike step with the cosmos like you, and then each of you reach out to the other. But even if the other person hasn't attuned themselves to the cosmos at all, they're still just basically a natural animal origin phenomenon rattling around, you will have a much more objective understanding of them, like parent to child, okay? And can strike step with them, where meet them where they are and as they are, just like Jesus did all the time. Right? I mean, he's going, you know, forget about his public ministry, third circler, right, going around the Mediterranean. Look at the way he struck step with, you know, everyone he came across, basically. Without needing them to have done much of anything at all on their own yet in terms of reaching up. But he fully understood them. And it's like, you know, he can, if nothing else, there's that little bit of manifestation that's coming from their thread of grace, and he can work with that and ignore all the other falderal, right? But he can see that thread of grace because he knows that, you know, internally. So he can easily recognize it in someone else and focus on that and forget about the other stuff. But until you know it yourself, you know, you don't see it in anyone else. All you're going to tend to see is, well, that's not like me, and that's not like me, and that's not like me. That's what you'll see. And in fact, I hate you. Right? I mean, that's where that'll go. Right? But once you know yourself, right, you'll know, you know, what they have in common with you by grace. And oh, what a delight it is when you stumble upon someone who has something besides just their initial thread of grace that you can resonate with. Someone who's taken delight in cultivating. Wow, is that a rare find? That's a pearl of great price. To find someone that, you know, it isn't just that little tenuous thread that you can blow on a little bit. Something that you can grab a hold of and really, you know, have that wonderful mutual edification experience with. All right, so deliberate disloyalty to deity. That's the concept. In other words, as far removed from even kind of the nuclear essence of transgression of taboo, as far removed from that as you can imagine getting. That's where they take you in one step. All right, you're supposed to make this infinite leap. To define sin in terms that humans have never even imagined yet. Right? You know, it doesn't matter what human has used the word deity. None of them have used the word deity like the Urantia book is using the word deity. Right? It refers to a concept that humans have never even imagined remotely yet. Right? No one has ever imagined what the literalness of deity is. And so in one step, they're, you know, wanting you to go to that. It's a huge challenge. Don't expect to feel anything solid with this definition immediately. You're going to have to let this grow in you over a long span of time. All right. What else do they say here?
Before you go on, oh, you got back to what Doug's comment mm-hmm. was, I think one of the ways that that you can kind of combine what you were talking about is, when he was mentioning this, to look for the good in others, to look for that part of God in others.
Yeah.
And that, is a, to me, is a way that you, when you do that, you see something that you have not seen before. And, you know, and that does kind of come out a little bit here and there. Now, it doesn't always, but I think that's one of the ways that you can do it by through relationship is what you're talking about. And it sort of opens that up, opens that relationship with deity up by looking for that.
Yeah, look to the part of them that you is enduring. I mean, how much time really should you spend focusing on an aspect of another person, you know, that will be gone in the blink of an eye when they die and are resurrected? I mean, really, think about it. I mean, you know, how fixated people get on some little wart on someone. I mean, that wart disappears in the blink of an eye cosmically. I mean, no one is resurrected on the first mansion world with those warts. I mean, why are you fixating on those things? It's irrelevant. Just forget about it. Focus on something that's real in the other person. Okay? Most likely they haven't gone to genuine sin and those real things aren't negative. Right? They're just an innocent child of God who's confused and whatnot. And it doesn't matter how many taboos or laws they're transgressing, okay, you know, they haven't impacted their soul one iota yet.
Jesus says some people
are
more weak and wicked.
Yes, right. Wicked is sin, right? I mean, you know, sin is a tall order. Most of us are way too animalistic to even get close to genuine sin. Okay.
The sense or feeling of guilt is the consciousness of the violation of the mores. It is not necessarily sin. There is no real sin in the absence of conscious disloyalty to deity.
I think I just said that. Yeah. Yeah. See, devoted a whole little paragraph to being emphatic like I just was. They just didn't have the exclamation points like I did. All right. I mean, saying it's not necessarily sin. I mean, you have to, you know, they can't be totally, okay, I mean, there is an occasional exception, but assuming someone is sinful is the last assumption. I mean, it is so not likely, no matter how egregious their behavior is. Okay, is it genuinely sin? Right? Have they transcended not only the God notion, but God himself and synchronized, you know, negatively with deity? I mean, seriously, no, not very likely, right? Give them that benefit of the doubt. And give yourself first that benefit of the doubt. You're not by nature sinful and unclean. Forget about your guilt.
They're correlating that if you were, you know, that direct with deity to the point where, you know, you'd probably still have a guilt feature.
Oh, yeah, right. Again, remember, you know, you would still have that quote-unquote conscience guilt feature. Remember, you know, even if you literally got a message from your adjuster, it goes through that conscience mechanism. That's the only mechanism that you have inside. For him to speak through. There's not some mystic, right, faculty, right? No, that's the only mechanism. You will feel that same basic subjective tension inside. Okay?
Know that there's all kinds of guilt.
Right. I mean, but by and large, our guilt is just a slight human refinement of what the dawn mammals experienced. Remember, they point that out, that literally the essence of this guilt thing, you don't even need mid-mammals to have it. It's all fully there in the dawn mammals. It's that animalistic, primitive. Mm-hmm. Right? What we are using to define sin, right, is the feeling that dawn mammals had. It's ridiculous. Yeah. And it, you know, you can't be more removed, right? The moment it's not just that lemur-like thing and is taking its first little step towards being human as a dawn mammal, you've got the essence of what we call sin, that guilt thing.
Designed in us, or
yeah, and of course you say, well, why is it that way? Why does it? You know, because it, like they're just pointing out, okay, it's there because it's the only way to get things evolving forward. You know, you have to go through all the taboo and fetishism and all this sort of stuff like we've been talking about. But eventually, when you finally have gotten to the most abstract, you know, essence of what was programmed into you as an animal, now. See the truth of that essence and take the big leap, like we're talking about, and just sever yourself from that whole lineage, right? But the lineage was there and all of its crudeness of cannibalism and all that sort of stuff, so that eventually there could be this essence that you could feel, you know, I think that's a shadow of something higher. Let's let go of the shadow and leap to the substance. Yeah, that's what the point of it is. And just the other little thing, notice that they, you know, gave you the contrast, you know, deliberate, you know, and remind you that's conscience, conscious disloyalty to deity. Right? Sin is not something, you know, that's going to be going on super consciously. Okay. Yeah, this is, you know, to get this in, it's got to be this very conscious thing. You have to, you know, have, oh, here's the function of deity. I see that. I'm going to do not that. Right? I mean, it has to be right up in front of your eyes that you're seeing consciously the contrast between it and you and picking you.
Where does law come into play? Is that essentially have to do with individuality? Or is there a place for law in our relationship to unity?
You're correct. I mean, it's about individuality. See, when I'm in the upper domain and I'm synchronizing with deity like this, I've turned my back on my individuality. And I'm, like I said, I'm focused on the unity side of the coin, the loyal side. Okay, but then I'm eventually going to turn around and face my individuality and issues of legality and, you know, the law. An individual is subject to these laws. But, see, I mean, another way to think about it in kind of a very transcendent way, legality or law, okay, that's the reality perspective. But remember, we're setting aside the reality perspective and we're thinking about the deity perspective. Okay, where there is no reality, there is no individuality. There's just the functioning of deity. And that's fundamentally what you, and the more you study deity, the more you recognize there's this parallel. Your upper domain is fundamentally in parallel to deity. Your lower domain is in parallel to reality and the seven absolutes of infinity. See, that's what I'm saying. I mean, that whole thing of trying to just get into this at-one-ment with, that the individuality, you're kind of anchoring yourself down in the lower domain. You need to let go. You need to transcend and really get to the upper domain, which means you're setting aside not only your individuality, but all individuality, even that individual, even the three infinite individuals. And you're just going to synchronize your highest functioning of mind with the functioning of deity. Yep.
But in my mind, you're taking your individuality up through the whole thing because you come to the ones that are up at the top, right, really, but portraying individuality.
Right, but you're taking the next step. I mean, I was just talking about the first step. See, once I fundamentally get my synchronization with deity, Okay, and I was given a relationship to reality and individuality by grace, and it's just there. Then you're going to do the super additive consequence of the relationship between the two and get a completely transcendent individuality of genuine oneness. But that's a very advanced thing, right? But you're correct.
I can't divorce myself from the individuality in the upper domain either.
No, you can't. But I'm just, see, it's just a, you know, you're not.
You said you're turning your back on it.
Well, yeah, right. But that's just, right?
That doesn't make sense.
I'm not turning my back on it, absolutely. I'm just for the moment, I'm setting it aside so that I can get deity firmly in grasp. And then I'm immediately going to use one hand to hold on to deity and one hand to hold on to individuality and reality. And so the two are going to come together. But just to initiate it, you know, you have to for a moment, set individuality aside.
I like the way you talked about that in one of the classes mm-hmm. where when you explained it, it was, you know, you have enough of a grip, you trust enough to turn around. And mm-hmm. you know, you can lean Great. On it. You know it's there.
Right.
But you have enough trust in it to turn around. You're not getting rid of it. You're not setting it aside.
Yeah.
It's there. You're just turning around. It's still there. You're still with it. It's just you have enough trust.
Yeah. Technically, if you want to know how you aren't really when you turn your back on your individuality, you aren't literally letting go of it. The trust thing that Katie's talking about, technically, how does that work? And this isn't just a concept that you believe. There has to be a physics to it where you don't literally lose your individuality, it evaporates. You know, how you actually maintain your individuality, you've got a little nugget that holds onto your individuality. It's called your thought adjuster. See, the thought adjuster, you're entrusting yourself and its individuality to your thought adjuster for a second. While you just focus on trying to synchronize with deity, you know you're not going to evaporate. It's okay. You know, he'll hold on to your individuality. I mean, remember, eventually he literally is your individuality, your body, right? You fuse with that individuality. Right? So the individuality, you don't have to worry about it evaporating. See, it's... You know, that just reminds you, really, to even begin this process, you need to have an adjuster. So the adjuster can kind of hold on to your individuality while you focus on trying to synchronize with the unity of deity.
What you're describing is the leap of, the so-called
leap of faith. Leap of faith, yes. Yeah.
Because what is the reticence, what's the fear when you want to make that leap? Is that not... It seems like, well, what if there's nothing there? What the real fear is, though, what if I lose myself when
right.
I make the leap?
Right, so your animal, incessant clamoring, is afraid it's going to lose itself, right? And so you have to overcome fear. You have to trust that that your individuality is still there. Like Katie was saying, maybe you just, if you can't totally trust abstractly, well, just think about that you're leaning on it. It's in the middle of your back. You can feel the ball of your individuality in the middle of your back. It's still there, okay. But you're just going to lean on it, and that frees, you know, your eyes and your hands to try to find deity, right? And not have to worry about holding on to my precious self, right? Right?
I mean, right? Nothing self-losing and self-forgetting of worship.
Right. See, again, it's all right there. I mean, forget about all this abstract stuff we were just talking about. If you just want to get to genuine worship, you have to get to self-forgetting. Okay? And again, it's just, that's why, see, fundamentally, you know what worship, the genuine worship is, in contrast to all the individuality things that humans have thought it is. Mm-hmm. It has to fundamentally have something to do with synchronizing with deity. Genuine worship. Of course, yeah, that's what it is.
I'm sure they describe something about tuning right? with worship.
And fundamentally, see, there's no individuality in mere genuine worship. The individuality comes back in on top of that new foundation. You know, what is it that you actually are technically doing, like if you're trying to reach to God? What's that word about the connection between the two individuals. There's a word that's kind of like worship. Adoration, right? The speaking to, adoration, right? I mean, you get this the foundation of deity, you've synchronized the deity, and then upon that foundation, or through that conduit, if you want to think of it that way, right, you do the one-to-one linkage of the adoration that you want to send to the Father.
And that's person to person, which is individual to individual.
Right, right. So, you know, you've got the God separated into the person and the deity. So think about synchronizing with the deity and then engage the person. Okay? All right.
The possibility of the recognition of the sense of guilt is a badge of transcendent distinction for mankind. It does not mark man as mean, but rather sets him apart as a creature of potential greatness and ever-ascending glory. Such a sense of unworthiness is the initial stimulus that should lead quickly and surely to those faith conquests which translate the mortal mind to the superb levels of moral nobility, cosmic insight, and spiritual living. Thus are all the meanings of human existence changed from the temporal to the eternal, and all values are elevated from the human to the divine.
Okay. You know, we've already, see, kind of already talked about all this. Why is, you know, kind of the basic energies of guilt, you know, they're already in the dawn mammals, you know, and humans just fancify it and make it genuine guilt. Why all, like they're saying, the whole point is that you've got the basic essence that you're going to play off of to get to the reality. And you'll get to that essence through the long evolutionary process where you finally separate the essence from all of the material substance, right? And then you play off that essence and get to the spirit substance. The possibility of the recognition of the sense of guilt is a badge of transcendent distinction for mankind. Yeah, like I was saying, I mean, technically the dawn mammal doesn't have guilt, but it's got, you know, all the energy of it, just, you know, lacks that little bit of reflective coating on it, right, that makes it guilt. Okay. And, you know, we don't often speak this way these days. It does not mark man as mean. You know, by mean we, you know, we don't mean the colloquial sense of you're mean, but lowly base, you know, and which you can tell by the rest of it, you know. But when it says, but rather sets him apart as a creature of potential greatness. All right, what are they doing there? It's something I do all the time. Don't judge it by its actuality, which is mean, which is base. Judge it by its potentiality. Right? What in actuality is low, in potentiality is high. It's just the opposite. Turn yourself 180 degrees relative to everything, like we talk about all the time, okay, to get to the truth of it. Now, the temporal actuality doesn't tell you the truth about anything, right? It's not the truths of time, right? It's the truths of eternity. Like they're saying, you've got to flip it from the temporal to the eternal, right? Which means you have to flip it from the temporal actuality that you can see to the eternal potentiality that you can only know by insight. You've got to make that transition. Let's see. You know, just all the very, you know, way they, you know, the way they pithily said some of the things we've been saying. Such a sense of unworthiness is the initial stimulus, right? See, it's just this little, yeah. In the sense, remember all those, like those four indispensables in the first half of progressing civilization are all poking, Right. Right. All these things that are kind of poking and prodding until you can, learn by looking instead of having to learn by leaping. All right, let's keep going.
The confession of sin is a manful repudiation of disloyalty, but it in no wise mitigates the time-space consequences of such disloyalty. But confession, sincere recognition of the nature of sin, is essential to religious growth and spiritual progress.
Yeah, so the first one is, I think, is pretty obvious to everyone. Even though, of course, a lot of people in the past have thought that there was this magical sort of thing. Remember that that's basically the way that they were interpreting the RE prefix. Remember we talked about that? It's like, ooh, this is magical. That's what the RE on religion means. And so we have redemption and all these other re terms, that it literally backs up everything and it's magically before it happened.
It never happened.
No. No wise mitigates the time space consequences of such disloyalty.
Until you do the Hail Marys.
Right, see, all that stuff that we think magically backs everything up. No, that's not what the RE prefix is about, is backing up in time. They're pointing out that even when you go to the proper definition of sin, you have this very important internal thing that has to go on. Because once you're not just evil, but wicked, no matter how much goodness I pour at you, I have no impact on you. I can't overcome sin with goodness. The only way the negative consequences of your sin are on the rest of us is going to be mitigated is internally in you. You have to get to this internal recognition point, like they're saying, sincere recognition of the nature of sin. In order to do it, you had this initial recognition, but you've got to finally get, yes, but that's too short term of a thinking. If I think more long term, no, it is the best thing to synchronize with deity rather than myself. Okay, I'll admit it.
Right? Right. Probably what all the rebellious angels had to go through when Jesus offered
right.
them.
Right. They've got to, finally let go of the fancy rationalization scheme, that was coding over the negativity of it, right? And see it for what it is, right? They were getting, too focused in the short term. They need to internalize their consciousness. Like they tell you, Lucifer got to the point where he goes, oh, duh, right? But at that point, he became what? What's the word?
Insincere.
Oh, sincere recognition, it says. Yes, right. He became insincere at that point. See, that's what they're giving you, that contrast. And as long as as long as you let go of that deliberacy, right, then if nothing else, right, if it's just merely evil because of you're ignorant and whatnot, it'll all work out, right? Influences on the environment will impact you and modify you and whatnot. I mean, things will go forward. I mean, religious growth and spiritual progress. I mean, but when it's sin, it's not, you're using your free will now, and, heaven and earth can't move you, okay? You have an absolute dimension to your free will, okay? Not even God himself can move you if you firmly grip. Okay.
The forgiveness of sin by deity is the renewal of loyalty relations following a period of human consciousness of the lapse of such relations as the consequence of conscious rebellion. The forgiveness does not have to be sought, only received, as the consciousness of reestablishment of loyalty relations between the creature and the Creator. And all the loyal sons of God are happy, service-loving, and ever-progressive in the paradise ascent.
Go ahead and read the violin.
Presented by a brilliant evening star of Nebadon.
It's kind of an interesting little thing at the end there. Since we know almost nothing of happiness, for them to say all the loyal sons of God are happy. Setting aside that little kind of sharpness of challenge there between the lines, see what they're doing. See, once you redefine sin, even like I said, in its most exalted thing, where it's all about this back and forth between you and God. Once you de-individuate it and make it about the attunement to deity, attunement with deity, I should say, more precisely, then you can say, kind of quote unquote, the forgiveness of sin by deity, see, instead of by God. Mm-hmm. Right? And because I focus so much on the attunement thing, I mean, you can see what they're getting at there, right? I mean, there's not, again, like I said, there's nothing that you have to go in search of, like they said there. The forgiveness does not have to be sought. Right? It's not, you're not trying to get forgiveness from God, across this gap of separation. None of that way we've always rationalized it. Right? It's the deity is already engaged to you. That nothing's changed. You just have to reawaken. Because to that fact, because you reestablish the attunement. And that reminds you of because you are, like I said before, because you're striking step with something that's dynamic, you don't just, it isn't that magical thing like a magical baptism. I got baptized, as a baby, so now I can be a mafia guy for my whole life, and it's okay, because I'm still magically in touch with what was magically, connected to me when I was a baby. Now, I mean, this is a dynamic thing that you have to be constantly doing. Now, the more that you do it, the more habitual it'll come, and the more you'll be attuned to deity without even thinking about it. But to begin with, you have to take delight in cultivating, right? I'm going to attune. I'm going to synchronize with it. I'm going to strike step with this dynamic thing. I'm going to be moving light with it, right? Okay, so all that kind of reworking comes into play, see, when you redefine sin.
So are you out of tune if you're not doing that?
Remember, by grace, there's always your, attunement that you have by grace, that initial thread of encirclement, and it's a full supreme attunement, okay. Right? So, that's always there. You're just trying to add to that, right? So you can never, unless you go to iniquity, okay, you can never go literally out of attunement, because there's a thread that's there by grace. Okay?
Thought adjuster.
No thought adjuster, just your encirclement in the Holy Spirit.
Your encirclement.
That's that initial supreme thread of attunement. And like I said, it's not just a finite thread, it's a supreme thread, so it's a very solid beginning. Right? You can trust that it's there. You're not iniquitous, okay? you're just going to try to add to that, and that'll come in fits and starts, okay? But like I said, eventually, there'll be more than just that thread that is just kind of there naturally. And then you're trying to add to that. And on and on and on it goes through endless cycles of eternity, right? That you're adding attunement. Circles of attunement around the initial thread.
Yeah. So you have the Father as love, the Son has mercy, and the infinite spirit is ministry. So really, as you were saying a minute ago, if when and if you do get to the sinning part, whether it's in this life or the next, whatever, because you may not be capable here, you know, if the sincerity is really there, then you have that love and mercy by grace, by, you know, to there, and you can, if you're sincere, you can turn around and be okay.
Yeah.
I mean, and,
yeah. If you just sort of take a hold of your sincerity again, right? It'll be okay.
I'm sure that happens to me. Look at all the people that happen to.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the rebellion, even in this, you know, universe, and though they say a lot of them, you know, haven't really moved on aggressively yet, but still, it'll be interesting to see how it all pans out. It's kind of interesting how they say so much good has happened from the bad, that far outweighs all the bad.
Yeah, that's a great point to bring up. For those in the webinar, if you didn't hear, he was reminding us of how they tell us how much good has come from the Lucifer rebellion, you know, much more than all the bad that will ever stem from it. You know, that's whole bit of, how do they word that before? Peace and consolation of mind and soul. One of the things that can help you with that is to remind yourself that, let's say you do, because of the evolution of our spiritual nature, you know, over the last several centuries, and maybe because you really put your free will behind it, let's say you actually do achieve sin here, even though it's a tall order, as we've just discovered. Guess what? All that sin, what will the universe do with it? It'll turn it into goodness.
Interesting.
Okay? All of the unconscious evil that you're doing right now, even though you don't want to, okay, when all is said and done, what does the universe do with it? Turns it into goodness, right? I mean, there's nothing, you know, all of this will come out in the end. You know, you don't have to heap undue burden on yourself.
So that's like, why they say to God, sin and evil don't really even exist.
Right. Because they can't even penetrate out of the finite to the supreme level, which means they have no connection to eternity. Okay? In supremacy, there's no badness. Okay? And so it just, you know, when you know, just knowing that, and maybe this isn't something that really relates immediately to you, but maybe there's someone you know that you fret about endlessly. They've really gone off the rails. They're not living life as well as they should or could. Okay? And you pray for them constantly. You worry that, you know, they're really messing, you know, their life up and all kinds of other people's lives. Okay. But again, in the step back and take a bigger picture, no matter how much evil or even sin literally, you know, comes from that close friend or relative of yours, it all is turned around into goodness. You know, once you expand just a little ways out from them or go forward a little bit in time, right? You don't add an existential weight to what's going on with them. Don't existentialize it and make it, you know, you get desperate and, you know, panicky and, you know, and are praying without sleeping, you know. I mean, it's like, no, you can let go a little bit. It's okay. It's just a temporal issue, and it's a very localized issue. The supreme mind can take any finite set of facts and do something good with them.
That experience.
Eventually, it's all okay. So. You know, engage them not with a with an existential worry for them or for others, but just a more practical, temporal, you know, try to mitigate some of the temporal issues. Don't worry that you have to somehow fix the eternal issue. There isn't really an eternal issue in play. Okay?
That's a very good example of the faith of Jesus in paper 196, what you're talking about.
But yeah. That's,
it's mind-boggling in a way.
Yeah.
And it's too bad more people can't, understand that.
Can't step back and be more objective about it. Yes, it is unfortunate.
Don't know it.
Yeah, but just I know is not easy to do. I mean, the closer the person is to you, the more difficult this will be to step back and be objective about it and not get all fraught, okay, panicky. We've just been studying. Go, wait a minute, I'm getting sucked into that long time old religion thing, okay. and I'm panicking that they're separating themselves from God, and there's no ransom great enough to redeem them, and I'm getting sucked into that. Don't let yourself get sucked into that. That's not real. God is still just as intimate with them as he ever was. And there's nothing to really be concerned about. See if you can just help them with the more material pragmatism things so that they can maybe have the environmental calm where they can kind of find their center again. And if they can restabilize themselves on the inside, then things will work onto the outside and it'll improve. But if you're desperately trying to somehow fix their connection to God in their inner life, right? That's silly.
Going back to the sin and the different degrees or whatever, different degrees.
Yeah. Different degrees of disloyalty.
Disloyalty.
Yeah, it may not technically be sin, but it's disloyalty.
Well, the death of loyalty exhibited in devotion to godless ideals.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that godless ideals, if we didn't have a relationship to spirit, we wouldn't have any ideals.
Yeah.
Ideals are basic. We only have ideals because of spirit.
So yeah,
what are godless?
Oh, okay. What is a godless ideal? I kind of hinted at as I was talking about it.
Yeah.
Okay, by grace you're related to spirit. Okay, so there will be ideals, and if you don't choose them to be, quote unquote, godly ideals, synchronized with deity ideals, they're going to be self ideals. Right? It's always the simple, it's a simple twofold system. If it's not the cosmos, the only other thing it can be is you. Right? So it's always the beginnings of the full dichotomy of righteousness and self-righteousness. I mean, you're always going to be exalting yourself as the substitute for the cosmos. And remember, like we've talked about, you can do this very solidly because you can take the reality response potential you have and falsely reify your own constructs. You can give them the apparent solidity of objective reality so that at a point it ceases to be kind of delusional and just, I'm not delusional. It's right in front of me. I'm poking it. It's as solid as the Isle of Paradise. But you've forgotten that you can make an imitation Isle of Paradise in your own mind, something just as solid as it really objectively is.
In fact,
Very vivid. Very vivid. You can squeeze it as hard as okay, no, I'm not making this up. This is real.
Well, okay? We're a long way from paradise, so the only thing we can have is a concept.
Right. But you get what I mean. I'm just trying to emphasize it. That just I mean you're the absolute I'm not exaggerating. Literally the absolute dimension of your personality allows you to make false absolutum in your mind. I mean, you can make it just literally, if you took it that far, okay, you're a finite being, you'll actually just make it supreme, okay, not absolute, but okay, setting aside the details, I mean, you can make it as solid as you can imagine solid being, or so it appears. So, these self-ideals can be very difficult to turn away from. It, you know, it can be very difficult for you to convince yourself that this is all of your own making. And, you know, we talk about this in, you know, all the time. Like you mentioned Vivid Islands. You know, a simple one is making a false thought adjuster. Right? You take one of your Vivid Islands of heat and you reify it. And for the life of you, you'll swear that nothing that solid could be of your own construct. That's got to be the adjuster. No, you can do it. Okay. So, if you actually bring your personality in, so it isn't just squishy mind, and you give it a false reality, this is very difficult to turn away from. To see through. Okay, so that's once you totally turn away from the cosmos, quote unquote, godless ideals, it's a slippery slope. You'll make yourself solider and solider, right? Until you make yourself absolutely solid, and that's called iniquity.
You don't have time to do that on this planet.
Right. See, and obviously, right. Yeah. Yeah.
It's the cosmos is real.
Yeah. So, you just, that double-edged sword is there to whatever degree. But, so they're just pointing out, if nothing else, there's a sequence here that, there's different stages of disloyalty. So it's another way of reminding you, don't get all panicky here. There's always a process. You whittle away at this. Seldom do you just in one leap just totally sever, and turn to self alone. Yeah. But so catch it in its early stages. Like, wait a minute, I'm starting to qualify things. It's like, well, let's just pretend that's not here, and. You're playing when you start playing games within yourself like that, so that you have these, partial things, like they're saying, and, divided things, notice that.
The rebellion study's all about that.
Mm-hmm.
Get you up to speed on that. Look at how subtle, but, consequences.
Yeah, and it definitely can be very, very subtle. It's they're giving you that sequence because, you don't have to make any jumps. It can be a total gradually, right? Yeah. So you need to be discriminating so you can notice the subtle things, right? And you won't be oblivious until finally it's a gigantic glob, and then it might be very difficult to deal with. Okay, well, I thought we might get into the next paper, but we needed to expand section 10 like we did. So next time we'll drop back again. We keep doing this as we go from paper to paper. They have, the other element. We've been talking about kind of the concept and the evolution of the concepts mostly. But we have the key individuals that have been orchestrating a lot of that evolution of concept, the shamans. So we need to drop back and sweep through the whole evolutionary sequence, looking at the individuals involved and how they played into this evolution. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.